This audio is brought to you by Muslim Central. Please consider donating to help cover our running costs and future projects by visiting www.muslimcentral.com/donate.
Right, assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Ahmadu wa salli ala Rasul Kareem, Sayyidina Muhammad wa ala alihi wa sahbihi ajma'in. Welcome to the new year 2020, and we're going to kick off with higher objectives of Islamic law, Makkah Sharia. And we have a lot of books on Maqasid now, recently, the last, I think, 10-15 years. It's a subject that almost everybody who is involved in institutional work should incorporate, but actually it should be for every Muslim everywhere. Unfortunately, it's a topic that most people don't talk about, speak about, or even read about. I once took Jasab Oda to a group of ulama, and one of the alims actually from a reputable institution said they don't teach this in our government. And I read somewhere that you can never be a proficient alim or somebody who doesn't understand Makkah Sharia. And I think it's an extremely important topic for Elijah Muslim. I've done some, many of you have heard my presentation, but we leave it to the chef of chefs, Ismail Kamran. So welcome. 6 weeks, bismillah.
Inshallah. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Alhamdulillah wa salatu wa salam ala rasulillah. Okay, so before we get started, jazakallah khair again to all of you for attending. Really excited to get started with this. This is a subject I've been wanting to teach locally for a long, long time. Before we even jump into the subject, just a brief background about the subject and my relationship to it. When I finished my Alim program about, I don't remember how long ago now, about 14 years ago, or 15, I don't know, about 14 or 15 years ago, I was in a state of mind where I, to be completely frank, I did not like fiqh. It was my least favorite subject, right? I did not like fiqh. And I spent the next 2 years studying Islam with scholars from different backgrounds, from different madhabs. I studied with all the different scholars. One of my friends introduced me to a book, right? The book on Maqasid al-Sharia by Ibn Ashur, the great Maliki scholar of Tunisia. And basically this course that we're doing, the 6 weeks, is primarily based on Ibn Ashur's book, right? So for those of you who don't know, Ibn Ashur rahimahullah was one of the greatest scholars of the 20th century. He passed away about 50 or 60 years ago. He was, I think, the Grand Mufti of Tunisia. And his book on Maqasid al-Sharia changed my life. It's literally the book that made me fall in love with fiqh all over again. And I've consumed almost every book of Maqasid I could get my hands on since then. Lucky for me, Brother Muhammad keeps them all. So I literally went to his stall and bought like 10 books of Maqasid, and I read all of them in 1 year. And this is really my favorite subject. It's a subject that I don't just want to revive it as something that's taught in 6 weeks. It's something I actually want to incorporate it into a high school curriculum. I want to incorporate it into a university curriculum. And really, I want somehow, some way to incorporate it into our Alim program curriculum. Right? These are the real goals with this. And this is just 6 weeks to show you why this subject is important, its relevance to your life, and why it's something that's necessary to revive in our times. So what we're going to do over the next 6 weeks, this week is just an introduction, right? I'm going to explain what Maqasid al-Sharia is, why we are studying it, so there's going to be some course objectives, the history of Maqasid al-Sharia as a science, and the basic terminology. So just like with Usul al-Fiqh, in week one we did basic terminology, right? So same with Maqasid al-Sharia, week one is basic terminology, because there's certain Arabic words I'm going to be using over the next 5 weeks. We're going to learn them today. Next week we will tackle the primary goal of the Sharia, which Ibn Ashur rahimahullah describes as the attainment of benefit and the prevention of harm, right? So this is next week's topic, the attainment of benefit and the prevention of harm. The week after that we'll begin looking at what's known in Maqasid as the dhururiyat, necessities. And basically in Maqasid al-Sharia, we're going to learn that the entire Sharia revolves around protecting five or six things. The ulama have difference of opinion whether it's five or six, There's five they agree upon, but I'm going to go with six because the sixth one I believe is something that I really want to revive in our time, something that's missing today. So, preservation of religion and human life, all the ulama agree upon those as the two main goals of the Sharia. We'll discuss that in week 3. Week 4, we'll discuss preservation of wealth and intellect. Again, everyone agrees on these as goals of the Sharia. Number 5, week 5, we will discuss the preservation of honor and lineage. Now, here there's a difference of opinion. Some of the classical ulama call it the preservation of lineage. Imam Ghazali split it into two separate maqasid, the preservation of honor and the preservation of lineage. Recent scholars like Ibn Ashur combine the two, and this is actually the approach I take, and he simply calls it the preservation of family. So that's the position I'm going to take, preservation of family. But I want to talk about honor specifically, because honor is a lost sunnah in our time. The idea of being an honorable person with honorable character is a lost sunnah in our time. And it's a very important topic to cover. And finally, in week 6, we'll talk about the secondary maqasid, which are called the hajiyat and tahsiniyat, which are generally translated as needs and luxuries. I don't really like these translations, but really, these words aren't very translatable. It's very hard to find English equivalents, so we'll just go with what's used in these books. So this is our curriculum for the next 6 weeks. It's a lot to cover. And a lot of this is going to be very new to you, right? Just before I get into it, show of hands, who's read a book or studied maqasid before? In any way, obviously, professor. Yes. Anybody else? Okay. Who's never even heard the term before? Raise your hand if you've never heard the term maqasid before we started these classes. Okay. Who's heard the term but hasn't studied it in detail? So raise your hands. I just need to understand the level of... Okay, so generally everyone here is people who's heard what's maqasid but never had an opportunity to study. So good, this is the right class for you. For those of you who've read it and or have listened to lectures or spent time with Sheikh Yasser Houda and these other great scholars in this field, this is a refresher for you, inshallah. Right? So, we're getting started, of course, most basic thing. What is maqasid al-sharia? Maqasid is the plural of maqsad. What is maqsad? It's a word that's the same meaning in Urdu and Arabic and many other languages. What's a maqsad? Your purpose, your goal, you know, what you hope to achieve. When you do something, you have a goal, you have a purpose, right? So when we say maqasid, we mean the goals, the purpose, the objectives behind something, right? So this is simply the plural of maqsad. The second word, we did it last year, sharia. Sharia simply means divine revealed law, right? Sharia are those laws that Allah revealed. So it's a very simple term. Maqasid al-Sharia, right? The law for construction. The goals of the Sharia. Meaning what? Maqasid al-Sharia is simply about trying to figure out why did Allah reveal these specific laws. And this is what Maqasid al-Sharia is all about. It's a human endeavor to try and figure out why. And just in that question alone, you understand its relevance to our time. Because we live in the age of why. Especially with our kids and our teenagers, they all want to know why. So if you're not teaching them why, you're not effectively educating them about Islam. So technically, the maqasid al-sharia are the wisdoms and objectives behind the revelation of Islamic law. It comes from the idea that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is al-hakim, most wise. Therefore, whatever law He has revealed is based on hikmah, is based on wisdom, whether we understand it or not. Maqasid al-Sharia is simply a human attempt and ijtihad to figure out what that wisdom is. Meaning, whatever we teach or study in Maqasid, it's based on the understanding of ulama. It's not something that's directly revealed. It's not like Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala revealed a surah saying, these are the Maqasid of the Sharia. Or there's a hadith that states these are the maqasid of the sharia. It's not like that. This is an ijtihadi issue. It's a matter of the ulama sat down, they did a lateral reading of all the different fiqh rulings and hadiths and Quranic verses, and they saw common trends. They saw common patterns, and they put these patterns together, and they figured out certain things. And for the bulk of it, they came across a ijma, a consensus. It's basically an ijma amongst the ulama in this field. Not ulama of all fields, but ulama in this field, on certain goals of the Sharia, and those are the ones we are going to study. We're not going to go into the ones where there's differences of opinion, or where one scholar said it but somebody else never said it. We're mainly focusing on the areas where anybody who wrote about this field came to a similar conclusion. From Al-Ghazali to Ibn Ashur, right? They all came to a similar conclusion. So why? Why do we need to study this? Understand, this is very, very different from anything that we are accustomed to studying or teaching in South Africa. In general, in South Africa, for us, fiqh is simply a list of do's and don'ts. That's what fiqh is. Do this, don't do that. Right? Usulul fiqh is how did they arrive at the ruling? How did they figure out this is halal or haram? Maqasid is why is the ruling there in the first place? Why? That's what maqasid is. Why is alcohol haram? Why is salah obligatory 5 times a day? This is what maqasid is, the study of why. So why is this important? Number one, to understand the wisdom behind the laws of Islam. It is extremely beneficial for every individual to understand why they follow what they follow. Right? It's extremely beneficial for any individual to understand why. Why do I pray? Why do I fast? If you don't understand why, what happens? It just becomes a ritual. It just becomes something that we do without, you know, without any purpose. If you don't have a goal, how do you know, in what direction you're moving in? Right? How do you judge the quality of your salah if there's no goal to that salah? How do you judge the effectiveness of your worship if you're not working towards specific goals in those worship? So understanding why is important for our own sakes. But it also helps us to appreciate the Sharia and the wisdom of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. A lot of Muslims nowadays don't practice Islam because they don't understand and appreciate the wisdoms behind Islamic law. They just look at it as a bunch of restrictions. You know, that's what it is for a lot of people. It's just a bunch of restrictions. I can't do this, I can't do that. And because they don't understand why they can't do those things, there's no motivation to follow. Once you understand it, you not only follow it, you appreciate it. You thank Allah for giving you these laws, because these laws protect you from yourself. They protect you from the harms that are out there in society that people haven't figured out yet. There's a lot of things in society that are extremely harmful, but humanity, due to following their desires, haven't come to the conclusion that these things are harmful yet. Right? Are we going to wait a few generations before we realize it's harmful, or do we just follow the law of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? The third benefit, now generally when we teach this to ulama, the benefit for the ulama is that they will use this in the ijtihad. They will use this in figuring out rulings for their time. For the average Muslim, it will help you to appreciate these ulama and why and how they are reforming their opinions for the time. Right? So you will find a lot of ulama across the globe from all the different madhabs who are changing their opinions on certain issues. And when you ask them why, they will talk about benefit, they'll talk about harm, they'll talk about the preservation of human life, they'll talk about the preservation of religion. If you don't know Maqasid al-Sharia, you'll have no idea what they're talking about. So at least to understand where they're coming from, you know, why are they taking this approach? It's important to understand these basic terminologies. And by the way, some people have the opinion that only ulama should study this field. Right? I'm of the opinion that only ulama should study this field on maybe a master's level. You know, go deep into this field. But I actually believe everybody, and I mean everybody, should have a basic knowledge of this field. To such an extent, I taught a very, very watered down version of this to my kids when they're like 10 years old. I mean, if you had to ask my 10-year-old son about why we pray or why we fast, they can give you reasons. Because I've taught this to them. Everybody needs to know basics of why. And that takes us to what is the main reason why I want to teach this and why I want to make this topic known in our community. And that is, when dealing with the youth or with people who are not Muslim yet, you know, those who are interested in Islam, when they ask you why, you actually have an answer. Right? When they ask you why, you actually have something that you can tell them. I mean, for example, the basic question. A youngster today will ask you, why is zina haram? If you understand Maqasid al-Sharia, you can give them an excellent logical reason as to why zina is not just haram, but it's harmful to society and it's something no honorable person should go near. But if you don't understand the subject, you may battle to try and figure out why is it haram? You know, why exactly are we told get married and avoid zina? What's the wisdom? What's the link? We'll come to that. When we come to the preservation of honor, the preservation of lineage, the avoidance of harm, in all of those we look at zina and why it's haram. But if you understand maqasid, it's easy to explain. This is why I really believe when, for example, when we're teaching kids around the age of 12 or 11 about puberty and about, you know, becoming an adult and becoming baligh, to teach them this. Don't just tell them, you know, you avoid zina when they're living in an environment of zina, or to teach them the whys at that age. So that they enter their teenage years with an understanding of, hold on, this thing here is going to cause me problems if I fall into it. So for our youngsters, it's very important that we understand why and we teach why. And that's why I want to have some version of this thought in our high school, in our primary schools. Same with people who are not Muslim. A lot of people are interested in Islam, but they don't understand, why do women wear hijab? Why do you need to pray 5 times a day? Why can't I drink alcohol? All of this is maqasid. All of this is, you know, explain the wisdoms of the Sharia. If you can give them an appreciation for this, then this may help them to inshallah take their shahada and move forward. And finally, there is a practical application to this. It's not just theory, it's not just something that's used in fiqh. Whatever I teach over the next 6 weeks, you can take it and apply it to your general life decisions. Do I do this or that? Whenever you face choices in life, I'm going to teach you next week how to weigh any life choice on a scale of maslaha and mafsada, which are two of the terms I'm going to cover in the next slide. You know, these principles can guide almost any decision we make in life. So our life choices become based on the Sharia, not just based on our desires. So this is why the subject is important, and this is why I really, really wanted to teach this and to revive the science. And now, I'm not really sure after the 6 weeks how to move forward with that. Ideally, you know, to find a way to get it incorporated into the high school curriculums, one good thing, Muhammad Yalgad Al-Ghazali kids series, that's the first step. I've been teaching that to my children. That's basically Imam Al-Ghazali's books brought down to a kid's level, and his books were the first maqasid books, basically. It basically goes through salah and wudu and fasting and explains the goals behind these things. That's a good first step. Now, to get that into the classrooms, they don't want murat in the classroom, so that's the problem, right? We need to get this stuff into the classrooms. That's really the goal. How do we move from? It's one thing for the 30 of us to know these things, but it needs to reach the masses. It needs to reach that youngster out there who wants to drink alcohol and wants to fornicate and doesn't understand why it's haram. You know, it needs to reach the person out there who's battling with, you know, becoming an atheist because the Sharia doesn't make sense to him. You know, it needs to reach the university students who are battling with practicing Islam on campus. It needs to reach everybody. So how do we get there? Inshallah, maybe we can figure that out together over the next 6 weeks. But that's the ultimate goal of this course, inshallah. So let's get started with the technical stuff. Hopefully it's not too much words for you. We'll get started with our terminology. As with any new Islamic field, you can't jump into it until you learn the basic Arabic terms. Right? Because every field comes with its own terminology. And the primary terms that you always hear scholars of maqasid speak about are maslaha and mafsada. Right? You always hear them talking about weighing the maslaha and the mafsada. Maslaha, we will give a detailed definition of it next week because that's next week's topic. But it's generally translated as benefit. Right? It's generally translated as benefit. Things which are beneficial to society and the individual is a maslaha. So an example of a maslaha in modern terms would be hospitals. A hospital is a maslaha. It exists for the benefit of society. It's something that's there, you know, to benefit people. In the Sharia, an example would be zakah, right? Zakah is in of itself a maslaha in the benefits it brings to society. So we'll discuss next week what this term means in details. We'll look at how it's used in fiqh and also how to use it in your daily decisions. The opposite of maslaha is mafsada, right? Which is a synonym for darr. So darar in qawaid or usul al-fiqh is harm. In maqasid, the word used for harm is mafsada. And they essentially mean the same thing. You know, in the Sharia, for example, alcohol is a mafsada. It's a harm in of itself and it causes all kinds of harms to society and opens the door to other harms. So when we are weighing whether something is halal or haram from a maqasid perspective, what we do is we weigh the maslaha and the mafsada. Because most things in this world are not black and white, beneficial or harmful. They're a mixture. It's a matter of give and take. You're going to find in life a lot of times you have to make a choice where every choice harms someone and benefits someone else. Which one do you go with? Right, so this is where maqasid comes in to help us to make the best possible choice. The next important word is the dhururiyat. Right? The dhururiyat is the necessities. Necessities basically, it's often described as the primary needs of human beings, without which a human cannot live a happy life, cannot live a fulfilling life. And so the entire Sharia revolves, this is the basic definition of Maqasid al-Sharia, that the entire Sharia revolves around making sure that people have these necessities. The religion, human life, intellect, lineage, and wealth. And Al-Ghazali added honor. Right? So these are called the necessities of life. Meaning, obviously you can't live without human life. I mean, we see that people in war zones and places like that, you can't live a fulfilling life. You know, protection of human life is primary. Protection of religion. We live in an age of atheism, which is causing mass depression and suicide and all kinds of problems. Right? Because happiness comes from Islam. Inner peace, that itminan of the qalb, comes from Islam. When somebody doesn't have a purpose to life, they don't believe in the afterlife, they don't believe there's any purpose to the test they are facing, then you know, life becomes extremely, extremely depressing. And therefore, the protection of religion is, of course, a primary goal. The intellect. You can't make sound decisions and live a happy life if your intellect is messed up through things like drugs and alcohol. I'm sure all of us have met people who, through one of these vices or the other, their intellect got so messed up they can't live a life. They just can't. They can't be happy, they can't function, they can't live a normal life. And so to protect our intellect, Allah has prohibited these substances. Lineage. Since the sexual revolution, how many people don't know who their fathers are? How many people grow up completely messed up because of all of these sexual vices that their parents indulge in? Right? So Islam puts a strong emphasis on the protection of lineage through marriage. That every Muslim child knows exactly who their mother and father is. It's a very important thing for one's psychological well-being, to know who your parents are and for them to be there for you. Then we have wealth ownership. Islam gives all of us the right to own wealth, to grow our wealth, while still taking care of the poor through zakah and through sadaqah and things like that. But the fact is, wealth ownership is a basic right in Islam. That's why, you know, I laugh at the idea of Muslim communists. You know, it doesn't make sense. When one of the basic goals of the Sharia is the protection of your right to own wealth, how do you reconcile that with communism? It doesn't make sense. Right? So the protection of wealth, this is why you can't steal, you're allowed to do business, all of these fall under the protection of wealth. And then the protection of honor is an interesting one, because Imam Ghazali listed it as the sixth, while Ibn Ashur combined it with lineage into one and called it protection of family. The protection of honor, this is something that's missing in our time. The idea that we should be honorable human beings and live a dignified life. I really think this is something we need to teach our children when they are 11 or 12 years old. When they're about to enter that teenage phase, that post-puberty phase, and face decisions that could really mess them up. To teach them about honor, about dignity, about being a real man, a real woman, about the qualities of a true man, a true woman, about being, you know, the kind of person that others look up to. This will help them to make good decisions. Because honorable people are generally happier. People who avoid things, habits that are dishonorable, people who avoid things, you know, generally honor is mentioned in the context, for example, of zina. That's the number one context it's mentioned within. Honorable people don't commit zina. Even amongst non-Muslims, I mean, the conquest of Makkah, right? At the conquest of Makkah, the Prophet ﷺ was taking the pledge of allegiance from the woman and men of Makkah. And part of the pledge of allegiance, the woman had to pledge never to commit zina. And one of these women, who was one of the leading mushrikas of Makkah, one of the leading idol worshippers of Makkah, and is now converting to Islam, and she has to take a pledge of allegiance to never commit zina, she gets offended and shocked, and she says, does an honorable woman actually do that? For her, it was like, how can you even think we'd do something like that? And she wasn't even a Muslim yet. But just the idea that somebody commits zina, even to the non-Muslims of Makkah, was a dishonorable thing. It's not something honorable people do. So we need to teach our children about honor. It's a completely lost sunnah in our time, and a subject that needs to be revived. And that's why I'm including it as the sixth maqasid, inshallah, in week 5. The other two main terms that we need to understand for maqasid is the hajiyat and the tahsiniyat. So hajiyat are secondary needs. That's what the hajiyat are, secondary needs. You need them to facilitate the dururiyat. You need hajiyat to facilitate the dururiyat. For example, the necessity is the preservation of lineage, right? That's the dururi. And the need, the hajiyat in that case is marriage. So marriage is necessary to protect lineage. So it's a need. Business or work is necessary to earn money. So it's a need. So needs are basically those things that are necessary not in of themselves, but to protect the first six. Right? So when we talk about the maqasid, the scholars put it in different levels. You have these six things, the whole sharia revolves. By the way, the point here is the whole sharia. Every single law fits into one of these six categories. You can find a way to fit into one of these six categories. That's what many of the ulama say. So anything you think about, you pray salah, that's protection of religion, right? You give zakat, that's protection of wealth. Stealing is haram, protection of wealth. Murder is haram, protection of human life. Alcohol is haram, protection of intellect. Literally any law you think about, you can find a way to fit it in with these. The hajiyat at the secondary level, they're what you need to sustain these. The third level is the tahsiniyat. And again, the word tahsiniyat, I have not been able to find a good translation for it in English. Some of the books translate as luxuries, some as adornments. Reality is, it's much more than that. Because for example, mustahab acts of worship are also called tahsiniyat. But they're not really luxuries. I mean, praying two rakats nafil or praying tahajjud isn't technically a luxury. It's just, it's not a need or a necessity. It's just something on top of that. So what tahsiniyat refers to is the third level of Islamic law, which is things that are not necessary. But when the goals of the sharia are fulfilled, these things now become available to you and they enhance the quality of your life. So when it comes to, for example, your iman, tahsiniyat when it comes to your iman would be praying nafil salah, praying tahajjud, fasting Mondays and Thursdays. These are now the tahsiniyat when it comes to iman. You don't have to do it. It's not necessity. It's not a need. But it enhances the quality of your iman. Right? When it comes to wealth ownership, everyone needs enough wealth to cover their basic needs. Anything more than that falls into tahsiniyat, luxuries. So, this is the third category of fiqh, and we'll cover that in the final week. There's two more terms I want to discuss, and often when the subject is taught, people forget to teach these terms, and it's very important that we understand these terms because they teach us the limit of this field. One of the mistakes people fall into is they forget there's a limit when it comes to understanding the goals of the sharia. And these last two terms help us to understand that. That's the terms ta'abbudi and mu'lal. Ta'abbudi and mu'lal. Ibn Ashur mentions these terms at the very beginning of his book, so that people start off on the correct understanding. Ta'abbudi, we can translate it, this is not a literal translation, but we can say non-rational. And mu'alal, rational. What this means is that when you look at the laws of Islam, there are laws of Islam that we can understand the wisdom behind, and there are laws of Islam which we don't understand the wisdom behind. You see, a lot of people fall into the mistake of thinking that every single law of Islam, we can explain it logically. Now, the problem with this line of thinking is there's a fallacy. It's not possible. Right? Let me give you a few examples. What's the logic behind Maghrib Salah being 3 rakat? Can someone explain to me what's the logic? We don't know. That is ta'abbudi. Allah told us to pray 3 rakat, we pray 3 rakat. That's all it comes down to. Now, we have to mention, Allah is Al-Hakim, most wise. So every law Allah has revealed has hikmah. It's just that sometimes we don't understand the hikmah. So we may not understand the hikmah behind why certain salah are 2 rakat, certain salah are 4 rakat, certain salah are 3 rakat. But we still follow the law, right? And this is why it's called ta'abbudi. Ta'abbudi literally means you are doing it out of worship of Allah without understanding it. That's the literal meaning here. Ta'abbudi means you are following the law even though you don't understand it, out of obedience to Allah, out of worship of Allah. So, about 10% of our Sharia, I'm just giving a rough number, about 10% or 20% of our Sharia, we can say is ta'abbudi. Meaning, there are things in our religion, if somebody asks you, why do you do that? The only answer you can give is, because Allah commanded us to do that. Okay? For example, tayammum. I mean, how does touching sand on your face clean you for salah? It's a ta'abbudi. Allah told us to do that, so we do it. Right? Why are there 2 sajdas and not 1? Allah told us to do it. So all of these aspects fall under ta'abbudi, things that we simply follow because Allah revealed it in that way. One of the clearest examples of this in the Quran is when the mushriks of Makkah argued about why is riba haram. Or in Medina, they argued about why is riba haram. And they said, what's the difference between riba and profits? Right? What's the difference? What did Allah say in the Quran? Allah has made business halal and riba haram. That was the answer. Allah made one halal, He made the other haram. That's it. You follow it, ta'abbudi. Doesn't matter if you understand it or not. Allah made one halal, Allah made the other haram. You follow. And so from there we get this idea that sometimes that's the answer. Sometimes that's the answer. Allah revealed it that way, that's why we do it. Mu'lal means you can understand. Right? So mu'lal is the opposite. You can understand why Allah revealed that law. Clearest example is the prohibition of alcohol. That's very rational. It's very clear why alcohol is haram. I mean, you don't need a scholar to come out here and give you a lecture about why alcohol is haram. It's something that's obvious to the fitrah, to human nature, that this thing is harmful to society, right? And the harms of it are clear and evident. So, when we say that in Maqasid al-Sharia, we are studying the goals of Islamic law, and that we are studying the wisdom behind Islamic law, it does not mean that by the end of this, you will understand every wisdom behind every Islamic law. Right? It simply means you will have a broad overview of the general wisdoms behind Islamic law, and for certain things specific as well. Now, one more point which I didn't mention on the slides. Sometimes the wisdom or the maqsad is mentioned directly in Quran and Hadith. And sometimes it's worked out through ijtihad. Examples where it's mentioned directly in Quran and Hadith, the verse about fasting. What did Allah say? لَعَلَّكُمْ تَتَّقُونَ, so that you may increase in taqwa. The maqsad is clearly mentioned, so that you may increase in taqwa. Charity. What did Allah say in the Quran? So that wealth does not circulate only amongst the rich. The maqsad is clearly mentioned in the Quran, so that wealth does not circulate only amongst the rich. Right? So certain things, the maqsad is mentioned in the Quran in very clear terms. With salah, إِنَّ الصَّلَاةَ تَنْحَى عَنِ الْفَحْشَاءِ وَالْمُنْكَرِ, salah prevents you from immorality and evil sins. So the maqsads are mentioned. Certain things it's not mentioned, but the ulama figured it out by studying it, right? By looking at the laws and finding patterns. So you have those maqsads that are clear in the Quran and Hadith, and those which are understood by the ulama, and then you have those laws where we simply don't understand why. And this, you know, one of my teachers, there's one thing I really appreciate about him, the issue of music, right? As you know, there's a difference of opinion there. Now, one of my teachers, he's of the opinion that it's haram. But if you ask him why, he says, ta'abbudi. He says, I don't know. Allah says it's haram, so I'm taking it haram. Very honest answer. Compared to many people who will give a long, rational discussion, which is full of loopholes. Because, let's face it, if you are following that opinion, it's not an opinion you can really explain logically. Because psychology and science have proven so many medical benefits of music. You know, for therapy and studying and things like this. So, if you follow that opinion, it's a very wise thing to say, I'm following ta'abbudi. I'm following it because Allah revealed it that way. Right? So again, there's a difference of opinion on that, but I just appreciate that about my teacher, that when I asked him why, he said it's a ta'budi issue. It's not an issue that he can explain rationally. And that's really a good approach to take when you don't understand something. If you don't understand something, it doesn't mean you just throw the law out the window. You know, if it's something that's clear to you in Quran or Hadith, if it's something that you honestly believe is the strongest opinion, sometimes you simply follow it because Allah revealed it, even if you don't understand it. So with that, we only have one more point to cover and then we'll open the floor to Q&A. History of this field. Who came up with this idea? How did it develop? Is it something new? Because some people think this is a modern idea. And they think it was invented in 1960 or, you know, some modernist in America came up with this idea. And where did this come from? Well, to be perfectly frank, in the early Islam, it did not exist. The first 300 years of Islam. Right? And again, the first 300 years of Islam, Islam didn't have fields of study yet. The first book of Aqidah was only written in the 4th century by Imam Tahawi. Right? Aqidah wasn't even a field yet. The books of Hadith were only written in the 3rd century. So in the first century of Islam, you're not going to have people talking about Mustalah al-Hadith and Ulumul Quran and Maqasid al-Sharia and Qawaid al-Fiqhiyah, because none of these fields exist yet. Islam was very simple back then. Right? So what you find is in the second century of Islam, we have Usulul Fiqh and Fiqh developing as our first sciences. Then the field of Hadith develops. Then the field of Tafsir develops. Then the field of Aqidah develops. And later on, during the golden age of Islam, when scholars have time to relax and sip their coffee and sit around and ask why are we following these laws, then Maqasid al-Sharia developed. It wasn't necessary in early Islam. That's not to say it wasn't there. It was there, but not with a name. Not with a terminology. Right? Like if you look at the rulings of Umar ibn Khattab radiallahu anhu, a lot of his rulings are very maqasid in their nature, in that he always weighed the benefits and harms, and sometimes even went against what the hadith would say or what Abu Bakr did if he felt that the other law was more beneficial. Right? So there are many, many examples in the life of Umar which clearly showed a maqasid mindset, even though the term did not exist in his time. Right? It's the same with Abu Hanifa. I mean, when we spoke about Abu Hanifa last year, we spoke about the concept of istihsan. A lot of his rulings come from istihsan. What is istihsan besides maqasid? It really is ruling according to the maqasid, even though he did not call it that, and the term wasn't invented yet. Same with Imam Malik when he made istislah, which literally has the same roots as maslaha. He was weighing the maslahas and coming up with rulings based on that. So, as a field, with this name and with this terminology, it did not exist. Right? But as a concept there in fiqh, internally, in the minds of the scholars, it's there. It just hasn't developed into a field yet. During the medieval era, right, we have the golden age of Islam, and it's during this time that we actually see the first books of Maqasid by Al-Juwayni and his student Al-Ghazali. And really, Imam Al-Ghazali's Ihya Ulumuddin, which is the oldest and most famous work we have in this field. Because anyone who's read Ihya Ulumuddin will see that in that Imam Ghazali discusses, for example, why we pray, why we fast, why we give zakah, what's the purpose behind these laws. And for every law, he goes into the why. This wasn't really done before his time. It was his teacher who started working in this field, and it was him who took it to the next level. And so we can trace it back to him. Over the next few centuries, we have Al-Iz ibn Abd al-Salam, Al-Qarafi, Ibn Qayyim al-Jawziyah, Al-Shatibi, many other scholars from many different madhahib writing about it. The classical works of Maqasid come from the golden age of Islam. Right? From the Maliki and the Hanbali and the Shafi scholars, very few from Hanafi scholars. For some reason, it didn't really develop in the Hanafi regions as well. Last year we spoke about the stagnation and decline period of our history, when everyone started blindly following, the quality of scholarship decreased, the ulama themselves started blindly following. That affected every field, including Maqasid. So there's many hundreds of years in our history where nobody is writing any books on Maqasid. No one's, and in some parts of the world they stopped teaching it, they stopped studying it, and our part of the world is still stuck in that phase, right? And in the past 300 years, there has been a revival. So the earliest I can go back to find a revival is in India 300 years ago with perhaps the greatest scholar in the history of India, Shah Wali Ullah Dehlawi, with his masterpiece, Hujjatullah Al-Baligha. The Hujjatullah Al-Baligha by Shah Wali Ullah is a book of Maqasid. It's perhaps the greatest book written by an Indian alim. And this is really, really fascinating about Shah Wali Ullah. Is everyone familiar with that name? Shah Wali Ullah, right? The sanad of almost every alim in South Africa goes back to Shah Wali Ullah. Whether they are Barelvi or Deobandi or Ahli Hadith. Everyone loves it. But for some reason, no one's following it. That's as blunt as it gets, right? Everybody says they're following him. I mean, even my sanad goes back to him, right? But when you actually read his books and you look at what we're following, it's not the same thing. I mean, he was a Hanafi, Sufi, who opened the doors of Ijtihad and told people not to blind, told ulama especially not to blindly follow. And he just has a whole chapter on this in his Hujjatullah al-Baligha. But I mean, look at the people who follow him today. And the Ahli Hadith are against Sufism, and then the Barelvis and the Deobandis are against opening the doors of Ijtihad. So who's actually following him? Right? It's really fascinating. Everybody loves him, everybody praises him, everybody traces their sanad back through him, everyone boasts about their sanad going back through him, but nobody wants to read his books and actually teach what he's teaching and actually promote his message. And really, this was the greatest mind that India ever produced. He was a scholar who was way ahead of his time. It's like you expect him to be in the 20th century or in the 21st century. But he lived at the time when the British were colonizing India, and his books were a response to them. And he was a response that, listen, these guys are taking over, things are changing, we need to reopen the door of Ijtihad, we need to look at the Maqasid, we need to do all of this. But for some reason, the generations after him, the work just didn't continue in that direction. So he was really the one who revived this field. Recently, if you go back 100 years ago, or less than that really, Ibn Ashur's major work on Maqasid al-Sharia, which had been translated into English, this course is primarily based on his book. And this is really the best work in this field, in my view. Modern times, we have scholars like Yasser Rawda, Yusuf Al-Qaradawi, and many others who are studying this field, who are teaching this field, who are writing in this field all over the world. There are many ulama who are going into this. So we can say that when it comes to Maqasid, we are in a revival stage. Why? Who can tell me why? Why are the ulama now suddenly realizing the importance of this field?
Being challenged. New challenges with the
new challenges require new thinking.
Immigrated, they now in minority communities, obviously, available in the internet, mixing with other communities, they brought up across here. And they ask why.
That's the main thing. And exactly, the whole reason why I started this course is because everyone's asking why, let's teach why. And this is really why this whole field is being revealed. I mean, if you look at Ibn Ashur's writings, even his book of Tafsir, he wrote this massive, beautiful book of Tafsir. I have it at home. It's in Arabic, it's not translated, but he answers why. You know, his whole Tafsir is like, the Orientalists say this, this is the response. The Orientalists are saying that, this is the response. He goes into the whys. Whether you're doing Tafsir or Fiqh. And that's the time we are living in, this is needed. Things are changing, new technologies, new societies, new cultures, new challenges. We need a new approach. But the beauty of Maqasid al-Sharia is it's not a new approach. It's simply reviving the approach of the golden age of Islam. Back then it worked, it can work again in our times. So we are in a revival stage of our religion. That's my belief. I'm very optimistic. Lots of people, you know, my kids tell me, my kids say we're living in the dark ages of Islam. I told them the whole history of the golden age, and they're like, we're living in the dark ages. So I'm optimistic. I'm like, no, the dark ages are ending. That ended with the collapse of the Ottoman Empire and whatever happened after that. The revival age is starting. And inshallah, we're going to start going up again. And part of this revival, people are reviving the fields of fiqh, of usul al-fiqh, of qawaid al-fiqhiyya, of maqasid al-sharia, Islamic psychology, Islamic banking, all these things are being revived in our times. So inshallah, this is the beginning of a new phase in our history, the revival era. And so that's a brief history. That's all for this week, inshallah. I don't want to go give you too much. From next week we will discuss the concept of maslaha and mafsada, benefit and harm, how it is used in fiqh and how it's used in usul al-fiqh, and also to teach you how to use it in daily life decisions. Very practical tool for our daily life decisions. The main takeaways from today. Number one, our religion is not just a bunch of random laws. Allah is Al-Hakim, therefore His laws are wise, and it is possible for us, for the majority of these laws, to know what the wisdom is. And that is what Maqasid al-Sharia is. It's the study behind the wisdoms of Allah's law. The ulama can use this for their ijtihad and for arriving at new conclusions for new issues. The average Muslim can use it for understanding and appreciating the law of Islam, explaining it to their children, explaining it to non-Muslims, explaining it to yourself, really. And also for daily life decisions. When you want to decide, you know, how should I do this or that, you can look at the maqas, at the maslaha and the mafsada and things like that before making your decisions. So, with that, we come to our conclusion and open the floor to Q&A. I think I'll put it back to the slide on the terminologies, so that I think those are where most of the questions will come from.
My daughter went from a private Christian school to now an Islamic school. MashaAllah, Islamic school starts off with the morning reading, Yasin, and rules and everything else. But he, having moved from this Christian school, the Islamic school, has never seen the level of tawheed. Straight after the Yasin, when they write the exam plan, and he was shocked. Because in the Christian school, we just didn't do it. I'm sure there were one or two, but this is a mess with the tacit approval of the teacher, because it's like the teacher's time to go. So it's because, oh, yeah. I'm not embarrassed this school, I'm going to have to make it up. So the point being, and this is exactly the discussion that we're having with that, is honor of saying that you copy. I give my word. Not because I didn't get caught, I'm not going to get caught. And she actually was like, you're the stupid one for not doing it. You know, and it just shows that same Yasin they were reading 5 to 8, 8 o'clock, and what happens if you start the exam? So, you know, it's clearly not.
Yeah.
They are not being taught. Like you say, just parallel to the Yasin.
So I really believe the concept of honor is a forgotten part of our religion. It's like, I mean, when was the last time you heard a Jummah lecture about it or read a book about it? You know, when I was young, I remember I was still an alim student. I was still a teenager, and I wrote a whole lecture out on the concept of honor. And my friends told me, nobody talks about that. Nobody wants to hear about that. Why are you writing about that? It was like, they're alim students as well, and they're like, this is a foreign concept, like, this has nothing to do with us. This has to be revived. I've met many young people who amaze me. I've met young people who, like, no matter what environment they're in, they don't commit zina, they don't smoke, they don't take drugs. And in most of the cases, when I ask them why, their parents taught them about honor. Majority of the cases, their parents taught them about honor. Some of their parents even made them take a commitment. When they hit puberty, some of the parents even made him make a commitment. I'm going to stay a virgin until I get married. Sign the paper. You're an honorable person. I'm not going to do these things. So they actually drive into them this concept of honor. Now these are individual families. The mass of society don't even know what this concept. They think it's a medieval concept. Honor. You know, knights in shining armor and you know, those days. You see, something that's needed today. You will find that in schools, it's very easy to follow what everybody else is doing. And I don't want to hurt anyone's feelings, but the fact is many of the teachers don't have honor either. Right? Many of the teachers are only interested in making sure that their class has the best grades. And the only way to get that is to let everyone copy. Right? Because otherwise you're going to get a few low grades and your class aggregate's going to go down and you're not going to get their bonus or you know whatever it is. So the honor needs to start from the top. Teachers don't have honor. I mean, they're the role models. What do you expect the students to do? So this thing has to be revived, and even though, as I said, even though it's not one of the generally listed five, but Al-Ghazali did list it as the sixth, and I really believe it will solve a lot of our problems if from the beginning we teach our kids about honor, and specifically at the age of 11 and 12. Specifically when they hit that age, because it is in the teenage years where they make most of their dishonorable life choices, which get stuck with them for life. These become addictions for life. whether they start smoking or taking drugs or taking alcohol, or whether they start committing zina, whatever these choices are, it has a lifelong effect. Right? It's something that's very hard to let go of, even if you reform later. So to teach them about honor from before that will inshallah solve this. But again, we have to get it into the curriculum, and we first have to teach the teachers about it, because if a teacher doesn't have any self-respect and any honor, that's what's going to be passed along to the students. So it's a very important subject for us to revive. Yes, Professor?
Abu Safar Sway, he is a specialist on environment. So he says that protection of environment should be one of the concepts.
It's a good point. Okay, so the point is that some of the, and actually Ibn Ashur also mentions this in his book, as does Yasser Oda and many others, they say that environmentalism can be listed as a goal of the Sharia. Now, for me, the problem with this is that whatever is the in thing, we suddenly list it as a goal of the Sharia. Now, technically you can say it is. I mean, environmentalism, without, even if that term didn't exist, our religion has made us Khalifa of the earth. We are in charge of the earth. Our religion prohibits us from killing animals without reason. We're only allowed to kill an animal in self-defense or to eat it. There's no other reason you're allowed to kill an animal. There's no hunting for sport in our religion. Right? Our religion has prohibited the chopping down of trees without a reason. Right? So all of this is there. So it is logically possible for someone to say environmentalism is a goal of the Sharia. I wouldn't list it as a primary goal. I would list it as something, what Ibn Ashur did is, under human life, he expanded it to life. So he says, so the classical scholar says preservation of human life, Ibn Ashur says preservation of life. Human life, plant life, animal life, everything. And that's where the environmentalism comes without, you know, exactly going to. The problem is, you know, sometimes when you use these terms, you want to make it sound like Islam is, you know, Islam is like with the times or whatever. And again, sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. But in this case, it just happens to coincide. I'm just skeptical about using specific terms, because what if that term, you know, the meaning changes in the future, and then, or it's no longer a cool thing, and now what they can say, oh no, it's not the goal of the Sharia. We're going to stick with it, we need to stick with it for the next 1,000 years.
When it comes to terminology, sometimes what is popular, what may not be a lot of benefits, may have baggage attached to it.
Exactly, yeah.
So, that
yeah, exactly. We don't. There's a lot of baggage attached to it sometimes.
My reading is different. I've read almost all the books of Mu'tazili. It's actually under nasab, because lineage, I don't think it's restricted to family. It is progeny, posterity, going down the line. So if you talk about preservation of progeny, your future generations must be able to
breathe clean air and things like that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So environment, that's why I think what you said at this step, I've also thought of, because of my readings, there's nothing that's not in the Mahasa.
Yeah. It all fits into one of these.
Absolutely nothing. So you talk about Nasr. Nasr means progeny. So remember, Ghazali talked about promotion and preservation, not just protection. Okay, so it's protecting, but also promoting, and therefore advancing.
Yeah.
So if we're talking about the future generation, with the climate change and water, if we don't take care of the environment, then we're creating a condition where future generations will not be able to survive, and therefore lineage or progeny will be there.
It's another way of
looking at it. So I think it is there. The one on honor, yeah, I think most people give it a 5 because they incorporate honor in some way, but yeah. I think it's singular.
Again, honor and lineage are normally put together as one.
I think it's important in that sense. But I think the idea of the Maqasid is, when I read it for the first time, early 2000s, to me it was mind blowing.
See?
I took a simple article by, I think all of us know, Umar Chopra, Dr. Umar Chopra, the economist, he came down. He wrote a very simple article on. And that's where my inspiration started, and that's when I started reading about this. Of course, he eventually published a whole booklet on it. But the next thing that I think that needs to be discussed, and many of the modern day scholars are writing about, is extending the scope of Mu'tazili. In other words, this was the traditional, this was the base, this was the foundation. But this extension, for example, medical ethics and everything else, the Islamic finance now are extending the maqasid to incorporate and how those rules fit the maqasid. Yeah. So I think it's a subject and it's growing, it's great. Oh, by the way, in South Africa, it's just the Leobindis, but at least don't know about maqasid. Yeah. Okay, sorry to say. But IFSA in Cape Town offered an honors degree, honors program in maqasid, Sharia. Under Jasser Allah. So they have an institution also. So in the Cape you hear it, but in the other part of the country. And I think the most, and I think you touched on the right point, why the Hanafis don't do it, because Imam Ghazali, Imam Juwayni were Shafis. And it came to a Shafi tradition. So Hanafis didn't fit into it. It doesn't make sense actually, because the Islamic knowledge is supposed to be from all the fuqaha, mm-hmm. just. Your Hanafi. So the Hanafis don't ever teach it in the rooms, and they don't talk about it anywhere else. In fact, one alim actually was asked to give a talk at one of the sessions, and he says, he opened his talk, and this is a mufti actually, and he says, I didn't know much about the subject until you asked me to present. Can you imagine him starting that discourse like that? So it tells you that we are far from it, and I think it's such a subject.
Yeah, we have a lot of work to do in this field. But really, again, my point is, if you look at these five or six words, again, everything will fall into it. We don't have to bring up other terminologies like environmentalism or medical ethics, because medical ethics is preservation of human life. Islamic banking is preservation of wealth. Environmentalism is preservation of life, preservation of lineage. You know, it all fits in without having to go into other modern terminologies. What we can do is expand the ijtihad to these areas that we understand medical ethics is based on maslaha and mafsada and preservation of human life. So to look at it from this lens when arriving at our fiqh, this is something which needs to be done. So this is a very important field. Whatever field you are in, to understand this is very important. We had another question. I think I'll take a question from the lady side now. Media wasn't what it is today. I think if the Ottoman Empire collapsed, they would all get a Twitter message at the exact second.
No, I know. What I'm saying is that if it was a whole
thing. Look, the Ottoman Empire for the last 100 years of its existence was grown very weak and very small.
Isn't it?
It grew. It didn't die in 1 minute. Yes, it technically collapsed 100 years ago, but the collapse started 200 years before that, right? So, for example, Egypt was part of the Ottoman Empire. In the 1800s, it fell to the British, and before that, it fell to the French. So, by the time World War I happened and the Ottoman Empire collapsed, it was a very... It wasn't the empire anymore. It was basically a few countries left together. And I don't think even the Muslims alive at that time really considered it an empire anymore. It wasn't something that collapsed overnight. It kind of fizzled out over 200 years. So it wasn't the event that we look at it today. We look back in history and say, wow, the last Khalifa, the last empire collapsed 100 years ago. The people alive at that time is like, oh, those guys came down and that guys came up. You know, for them it was just like World War I. There were bigger things going on in World War I. Millions of people were dying, entire countries were falling apart. You know, the British and French took over most of the Muslim countries. Those were the bigger concerns for them at that time. For us, 100 years later, it's a big thing. But as I said, it wasn't an overnight thing. It was 200 years of collapse. For 200 years, the Ottomans were called the sick man of Europe. They were the most backwards and technologically weakest country in Europe. And step by step, the Europeans, other countries, the French and the British, taking over Egypt, taking over this country, taking over that country. And finally, they collapsed in 1920. So that's probably one of the reasons why. Any other questions?
Malaysia and Indonesia, because
became Muslim is because of the honorable feelings of people in the trade. Similarly, many of the Sahaba, but that was very important. But if we look at it in today's time, that's very, very critical and important, because just 2 decades ago, when our our grandparents and our uncles, except our uncles, but these are grandparents, when they were called in courts, their word was taken seriously. And they deserve their honor regardless of the consequences. In today's terms, in the business world, for example, it's actually pathetic at the level of committing and honoring your debts and things like that. If you just look at the state of our nation in terms of honorable commission and what transpires there, it's actually, this is really something that we can, as Muslims, contribute to. And yet, sometimes Muslims are party to this.
It's a difficult conversation to have in our time. I think one of the reasons why many of the early scholars never listed it as one of the goals, as you mentioned, it was such an ingrained part of being a Muslim, it never really needed to be discussed. It was just a natural part. You are Muslim, you don't lie. You are Muslim, you don't cheat. It's just like part of the fitrah. We live in such a time that Muslims tell me they don't want to work for other Muslims. They don't want to do business with other Muslims because they've been cheated by Muslims and oppressed by Muslims so many times in the city that we live in. And even non-Muslims, you know, I was talking to a Christian the other day trying to do dawah, and he's like, I can't take you guys seriously. I asked him why. He said, none of our kids smoke. All your Muslim kids after Jummah, they're outside the mosque smoking. Your people got no honor. That was his exact words, your people got no honor. If your kids stand outside the masjid smoking and you're fine with it, he said, you'll never see a Christian kid outside the church, his church smoking. They teach their kids from a young age not to do these things. So, I mean, look at how people are perceiving us, because we've completely let go of our honor. And it's become an embarrassment that, you know, I personally know people who were so disgusted by the actions of the Muslims that they left Islam. They're like, I don't want to be part of this community who behave like this. So this is, again, even though it's in the past it wasn't listed, I'm bringing it back up because we need it. We need to discuss it. We need to talk about it. We need to show how the Sharia evolves around it. And we need to find a way to bring it back into our lives and back into our community. Because without honor, we are never going to, even though not grow, we are going to fall. We're going to lose our youth. Right? They're either going to fall into dishonorable practices themselves, or they're going to be disgusted by the dishonorable practices around them and seek other paths. And so we have to find a way to bring this back. It's really, really a major issue of our times.
The pledge of Aqaba, you know, is very profound, very deep. That was a pledge, it's like an accord, you know, the Cape Accord, this accord. It's an accord, it's a pledge. And what are the fundamentals of that? Do not steal, do not commit zina. That's a pledge of honesty. And these are new people coming to Islam. And the Prophet gives them this pledge that they will start getting rid of some of the practices that were Jahiliyyah had ingrained in them and to move towards a new life. So that, in a sense, honorable. So maybe Ismail, since you're raising it, is draw up something, a pledge for Muslims to, like an oath, you know, a physician's oath, or just something to start debating and maybe putting out to schools and putting up to madrasas and say, look, do you pledge to not steal this, that, the other, like the Ten Commandments?
Yeah. What I was thinking about very similar to this.
That might be one way of reviving the idea. Yeah. That we need to be honorable, we need to be honest, we need to have justice. Justice is next to taqwa. I mean, if you don't have justice and you don't involve yourself in just social justice, for example, where is your taqwa? You know?
I've been thinking about this a lot recently because my kids are approaching their teenage years. Next year, my eldest will be a teenager. And I've been thinking one of the things missing in our community, we don't really have an initiation phase where our children go from child to adult. That's why many of them are stuck as man-child right into their 30s. Right? Because we don't have that initiation phase. I mean, what if in our kids' puberty, we make them take their shahada and take a pledge of like this, you know? Make them sign a contract that I will not steal, I will not fornicate, things like that. Because they need to realize now that, hold on, I am now mukallaf, I am now baligh, I am now responsible for my actions. Many of our people who are 17 or 18 years old don't even know they are mukallaf, that they are responsible for their deeds. They don't know. They still believe that they are children. They still believe that You know, they're not going to get sinned for anything they do. Because we don't teach this. We don't have that phase where a boy becomes a man or a girl becomes a woman. You know, it's just... I mean, look, in the olden days, puberty was the difference between a man and a child, an adult and a child. Nowadays, we have this confusion where when a person hits puberty, on one hand, the parents tell them, you are a man now. On the other hand, the next day, it's like, go to bed at 10 o'clock, you're still a child. And so now, for the next 8 or 6 years, they have this confusion. Half the day, the mother tells them, you are a man, go play 5 times a day. The other day, they think, you're a child, go and do your homework. Right? So it's a very confusing time. So when do we do this initiation? When do we tell a child, you are now a man? I will treat you like a man. And I noticed this in some families. Some families I know, from the time their child hits puberty, they treat their son or daughter as a man or a woman. Those kids have matured faster and have been more successful in life. Because they don't go through that confusing period. And the confusing period sometimes lasts right into the 20s, sometimes right into the 30s. Because there's never a phase where a child's parents now start treating them as a man or a woman. They still treat them as a baby, right, at that age. So we need to figure out some way to bring this back. These are some ideas we're discussing. There could be other ideas as well, inshallah. But I really like the idea of doing some kind of pledge with them when they hit that age.
When it comes to honor, part of it now is that you get the child to understand why. Build this up, being honorable. And also, upwards now, honoring their parents.
Yes.
So if we then, in turn, honor their parents, it doesn't become a question of now, why are you treating me like a child? It becomes, I'm honoring you by following your instruction. Not that you are, why are you boss of me? I'm my own man. Become, if we dig from a more base level, we don't get to that question because they're now honoring the parents.
That's true. So again, it needs to work both ways.
I think the other topic is ethics. That's another subject matter because that leads to. What happens is that we don't teach ethics in our madrasa. We don't have a subject called ethics, which is akhlaq hijab, right? So if you don't have that foundation, you can't be honorable in your dealing, you can't be honorable in your conduct. So ethics, I think, is the most important. We done.
Okay, before we close off on my side, my new book's out. For anyone who wants a copy, this one's going for 500, this one for 200. I've got copies with me. This is my latest book. I just received the shipment today. So in the life of Umar bin Abdul Aziz, the 8th Umayyad Caliph, from a productivity perspective. I analyze his life and I extract 15 productivity principles from his life. It's something that I don't think anyone's done before, combined Islamic history with self-help. So if anyone wants a copy, I have them with me, 500 rand. My other book from last year, The Book of Hope for Sinners, basically a book on how to repent and how to become religious again after falling into major sin. Alhamdulillah, it benefited hundreds of people around the world. Anyone wants a copy, again, I have them with me in the car. They're 200 rand. So again, if you want a copy next week, can't guarantee I'll still have them, but inshallah.
JazakAllah khair, Ismail. So this is the first week we have every week, Monday at the same time, 8 o'clock. We'll change as we go along, the quantity becomes a bit earlier. Some of the material is already on the YouTube channel for Ismail Kamda, also on the forum website. I'm not sure whether my technical person posted this particular set of slides, but I have it done by tomorrow. So you can download the slides. I think about 4 of the videos with the slides have already been uploaded. So anybody who wants to go and look at it, it's all available. I'm hoping to do it every week. That's one. Number 2 was, I think all of you are familiar with this Ottoman Empire issue. Okay. Sheikh Bilal is going to be speaking on the rise and fall of Ottoman Empire from Urtugun to Ataturk. Okay.